Warning, this episode contains spoilers, coarse language, and an elderly cherub in a red suit.
Something that's really well done the first time. It's not broken. Stop trying to smash it.
I'm always intrigued to see what it is that people are going to do with something that's already been done before.
I hate remakes.
I love remakes. Welcome, everybody, to part two of I Hate Love Remakes, episode 13. I am Noel, and joining me, as always, is Evie.
If I can find the meaning of Christmas, everything will go back to normal. Asterix.
Well, the meaning of Christmas is a very deep and profound meaning. Basically, it means get drunk on eggnog and wake up with new things in your possession.
Like candy!
Yes.
And severed heads?
If that's what you wished for and the elf had the chainsaw that could do it.
Mumbletop.
So, joining us again is our friend Carrie. How you doing, Carrie?
Hello! Again.
So, Evie, you want to tell us what we're going to be covering in this episode?
Well, we're going to be doing Fright Night at... No. We're doing Miracle on 34th Street from 1994.
I was about to say, I haven't seen a Fright Night, so...
You're like, I don't know, watch that. You guys tell me it was a different movie.
What show am I on again? What dimension am I in?
Well, if we all have the beards, then you're in the evil dimension.
Yes.
Oh, wait, Noel's here. It must be the evil dimension.
Well, I'm in the evil dimension. That doesn't mean you two are in the evil dimension, because we're on Skype right now, which manages to cross the dimensional plane.
Ah, like it.
It transcends the boundaries between here and now and forever.
No wonder it has so many problems.
So yes, we're covering the 1994 Miracle on 34th Street, directed by Les Mayfield and written by John Hughes. So we all know who John Hughes is, right?
He was a dude that made some movies in the 80s, right?
That's right. You're the young member of the group.
No, I was joking. I've seen all of his movies, just about.
Oh, yeah. John Hughes. This was pretty late career John Hughes before he stopped giving a damn. And
you wrote Toy Story, right?
Toy Story?
That was Joss Whedon. That's the joke. That's the joke, Noel. That's the joke.
Okay.
It's no longer a joke because I had to explain it, but, you know, it was there for a minute.
Yeah, this was among the last few films he wrote, and kind of is considered to be the tail end of his career, because after this, all he did was 101 Dalmatians, Flubber, Home Alone 3, and then he did Just Visiting and Made in Manhattan, and then he was pretty much done. Which was unfortunate because, yeah, John Hughes, talk about probably one of the key filmmakers of the 80s generation.
And with Made in Manhattan, he was credited under a pseudonym, specifically because he did not want to be associated with the movie.
Well, they rewrote his script and he took his name off it. So yeah. Same with Drill Bit Taylor.
Oh.
Which is actually based on an outline that he wrote in the 80s. So, and then he passed away a couple years ago. So rest in peace, John Hughes. It's going to be interesting to talk about this one because this was kind of the, as we said, the tail end of his career. He kind of had his main peak around the late 80s, early 90s, and a lot of people are very kind of critical of the commercialization of the films he made after this. And not so much me. I mean, a lot of people kind of dismiss Home Alone, which he wrote and produced a couple years before. But I think Home Alone is right up there with the best of his stuff. Great Christmas film, one of Chris Columbus's best films.
Oh, yeah. I love him. He defined my adolescence. I wish he had adopted me. The end. Honestly, if you haven't seen a John Hughes movie, again, welcome to our planet. This is Earth.
Right. I don't know if anyone can ever go their lives without seeing Ferris Bueller just because it is on TV like every week.
And 16 Candles.
Mm. Yeah, 16 Candles, yes. Just one of the greats, one of the absolute legends, especially of our generation. And it's going to be interesting to discuss this film because I have quite a bit to say about this film. So.
Oh, as do I.
Then there's the director, Les Mayfield. He's also done Encino Man, Flubber, Blue Streak, The Man, and codenamed The Cleaner.
Oh, God.
Not exactly someone who went off to have, like, a star career. And
no, I quit. You can't make me do this. No.
I'll replace you.
Oh, he had a film, American Outlaws.
Oh, God.
Which had an amazing script. I loved the script to that film, and I watched it, and he didn't change the script at all. He just directed it with such a level of incompetence that it was just mind-boggling how he completely screwed up that film. And then The Man, with Eugene Levy and Samuel L. Jackson,
exist?
Which should have been a hilarious buddy cop movie and was just awful. Awful film.
I think there's a good reason why I haven't heard of some of these movies.
Right. And he actually hasn't had a single credit in the industry since 2007. So maybe they got wise and stopped letting him make things. You know, Encino Man was cute, though. Got to give it that.
I suppose. It was cute. It doesn't really hold up now, but it was cute.
I haven't seen it in a while. So I got to dig it out for a Pauly Shore-a-thon.
It can't find, but it's not that great.
Yeah, but it's got the weasel. So, Pauly Shore, I loved him back in the day. I haven't revisited him since. So
oh, God.
So do we want to dive into a synopsis?
Maybe. Sure.
Okay. Dory Walker is the events director at Kohl's, and that's C-O-L-E-S Kohl's, not K-O-H-L-S Kohl's, as in the actual Kohl's that exists. And she's in the final stages of getting everything prepared for the Thanksgiving Day parade when a kindly old man named Chris approaches her and points out that the man she hired to play Santa Claus is inebriated. Dory fires the drunk and, noticing that Chris closely resembles Santa, hastily offers him a contract to take over the position, first on the parade float, then in the Kohl's store itself as they approach the holidays. Chris becomes quite the sensation, especially when parents start spreading word that he's telling them where to find the toys their children want at the best prices, even if it's not at Kohl's. Though initially hesitant, the higher-ups realize such a notion has done wonders for their public image and turn that into their store policy. The store had been struggling to stay afloat to this point, with their rivals at Shoppers Express all set to buy them out. But the huge boom in publicity and business has undone that deal, and Shoppers Express is trying to find some way to either compete or tear Kohl's down. Dory became disillusioned when a man left her after getting her pregnant and has raised her young daughter Susan to only believe in absolute facts and reality, meaning the girl doesn't believe in Santa Claus. Dory's neighbor and token love interest, Brian Bedford, is sad to hear the girl doesn't have any fantasy or faith in her life, so he takes her to see the Santa at Kohl's. Dory is a little miffed at this, especially when Chris repeatedly claims he really is Santa Claus. Taking a look at his contract, she sees he actually did sign himself up as Kris Kringle from the North Pole. The higher-ups are again frightened, but decide to give him the benefit of the doubt because of the huge publicity surrounding him and because he's not violent. Latching onto what they see as a potentially dangerous delusion, the Shoppers Express executives hire the goon who was earlier fired as Santa Claus for being drunk to stalk and harass Chris, which becomes so severe and insulting that Chris attacks the man with his cane. Chris is shipped off to Bellevue Mental Hospital, his disheveled, shocked face captured in a photo on the front page of every newspaper. On top of this, Brian proposes to Dory, but she turns him down. Brian, a lawyer, comes to Chris's defense and argues at a formal hearing that Santa Claus exists and Chris is indeed that man. The trial quickly becomes a media sensation, with the judge worried about his re-election should he rule there is no Santa Claus, and the prosecuting attorney balking when his own wife takes a stand to admit they've both told their children that Santa is real. Susan, who's come to believe Chris might indeed be the real thing, gives the judge a Christmas card. Inside is a $1 bill with the words "In God We Trust" circled. The judge declares that if the United States government can accept the existence of God on faith alone, then the people of New York can also recognize that Chris is Santa Claus. After sharing in the victory, Chris heads out for Christmas Eve. Earlier in the film, Susan told Chris what she really wanted for Christmas was a house, a father, and a baby brother. Immediately following the trial, notes from Chris trick Dory and Brian into meeting up at a church where they decide to go ahead and marry. Then they take Susan out to the girl's dream home, a richly furnished house used for the store's catalog. Dory thinks they're there for another photo shoot, but is surprised when her boss gives her the home as a bonus for all the profit she made the company by hiring and defending Chris. Susan tells the couple about her wish and how she's gotten a father and a house, but they still owe her a brother. So, Evie, do you recommend this film?
I do. Probably not as strongly as I did the original, but yeah, I still do. It's still a fun movie, and Richard Attenborough is still a really good Chris. Honestly, I think the only thing is it lacks a certain heart or a certain innocence or a certain something that the original had. But it's still a really enjoyable movie.
Okay. Carrie, do you recommend this film?
Not particularly. It didn't like feel as natural as the first one did. There were just at times just thinking, well, I would just rather be watching the original, maybe watch this movie on a rainy day or something. But I didn't think it like flowed well as the original did. And it didn't feel like it was its own movie. Do you get what I'm saying? But yeah. Like it was just copying the original with a few tweaks here and there.
Yeah. I recommend this movie, but there are flaws with it. I like most of the cast. I like a lot of the sequences. It does capture a lot of the heart and charm and wit of the original film. The problem are when it tries to do something new. The whole Shoppers Express bit feels a little cartoony in the way that they're constantly trying to sabotage Christmas and all that stuff. There's an odd religious angle that's been added to the film.
As long as I'm not the only one who saw that.
You know, the original film kind of had its charm because it played with belief in a very light way. It was more about having that kind of innocent belief in fairy tales and magic. And this one equates belief with Santa Claus with belief in God. And it feels heavy-handed and comes off preachy, whereas the other one came off charming. And also, Dylan McDermott felt like he was in something else. He felt a little out of place.
I concur.
So let's dive into discussion. Why don't we just go ahead and jump on this the religion angle? It's a part of the film, so we got to discuss it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Actually, the first time that Dory and Brian go out and, like, you know, they're supposed to go shopping and on a date and whatever, and they get in the cab and it starts driving, and then there is a building just off in the distance, and the way that the lights are, it's in the shape of a cross. This is fairly early in the movie, so I was just like, okay, you know what, maybe it's not going to be so blatant, and then it is. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to say that that was intentional at that point.
Right, and like, you know, they take jabs at Dory for not being a believer, like the bit when he wants to say grace at the meal.
Yeah.
Or like the bit where Brian leans down to Chris and says, non-believers. It feels a little snide.
Yeah, it's just like, you know what, not everyone has to believe in Santa Claus. It's a matter of whether you want to or not.
Right. In the original film, it didn't feel like they were criticizing Doris for not believing, but in this film, it feels like they are.
Well, for both not believing in Santa Claus and also not believing in God.
Well, they kind of play a little light with that. They don't entirely say that she doesn't believe in God, but they do take some swipes at it.
They don't outright say it, but it's all over the place. I'm like, do you have your God is really awesome cheering squad? Because
right. And then there's the bit where Chris himself says, if you can't believe in anything on faith alone, then you're living in a life of doubt.
Yeah.
It feels preachy, and it feels like they're taking this message about being open to the fun of fairy tales and magic and turning it into a sermon.
When Chris is in, I don't know if it's still Bellevue this time, and they have the like light shining and they have the hallelujah chorus. And I'm like, you guys, he thinks he's Santa. He's not Jesus.
Right.
Tone it down. Like, you would think that instead of just sending Santa to the nut house, they'd crucified him or something. I'm like, you guys, relax.
It's like, and during the trial, they have to outright say, we're not debating whether or not God exists. And then I don't entirely mind the use of the in God we trust on the dollar sign, but saying that there's a recognition that God exists equates an ability to recognize that Santa also exists is, again, a false equivalency.
I'm like watching it going, wow, that would so get overturned like that in appeal.
Even most people who believe in God stop believing in Santa after age 4, you know?
Yeah.
I'm surprised that it's there, that they went there.
Also, in the original, they played more with the is he, isn't he, whereas with this one, they're more or less stating that he is.
The original, it was more ambiguous.
Yeah, this one, it's much more that he is actually Santa Claus.
I am really surprised that we didn't see him get on his sleigh and take off in the air at the
end. Yeah, I was expecting it by the end. Like, all things considered, I was just like, so we're not just doing that one? Because that's where we were going, pretty much.
Right. Carrie, what do you think?
It was odd.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with Christmas movies that, you know, offer up a religious belief. I just don't entirely understand why they felt the need to tag it onto this story.
I could see what it was going for, but it fell short.
Yeah.
It had good intentions, but it just...
It had good intentions, but If anything, I don't mind that they added characters who have religious beliefs, but I don't like the snide jabs that were taken at Doris and Susan because they aren't believers.
Yeah. Like, there's something wrong with them because they don't believe.
Right. It lacked the all-encompassing warmth of the original. I mean, I'm an atheist, but I can still find the original really warm and charming and inviting because it's not about faith and belief. It's about just believing that something magical can happen, you know?
Exactly.
And that everyone can come together and have a magical experience on Christmas. This one, it's more, I don't know, it's heavy-handed.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Richard Attenborough as Santa Claus.
He's lovely. He's not as good as Edmund Gwynn.
Well, it's kind of hard to say which is better or not, because I think they're both great in their own right. They're a little different.
Mm-hmm.
This one has a little more edge to him.
Yeah, he is a little darker.
Well, he has a bit of a sharper look to his eyes, too, that can't entirely hold it against him because that's just what he looks like. But I thought his performance was good.
But the cane that they gave him, I thought was like, that scared the crap out of me.
Yeah, they really overplayed the silver-handled cane that he would thwack people with.
Yeah, I'm like, that looks like a hitting stick.
That looks like, you remember the Fog episode?
Mm-hmm.
Where the pirate had the wolf-headed silver cane that he would knock on the door with?
Right. Yeah, that.
So Santa will be lurking outside your door on Christmas
Eve.
With
his cane.
With his zombie reindeer, just looking to stab you on their antlers. And
don't give Robot Chicken any more ideas.
That was a bit of the heavy-handed nature of this film, too, in that, you know, the cane is a necessary plot element, so we gotta establish. In the original, it was just there, and then he ended up using it. In this one, it's like, we gotta set it up, we gotta remind people, and then he uses it.
Mm-hmm.
They overplayed it. They tipped that hand a little too far.
Yeah.
But as for Attenborough himself, I didn't have any problems with his performance.
I'll say, personally, I didn't like him as much as Edmund Gwynn, but that's because, you know, for me, Edmund Gwynn is, he's essentially my granddad, so.
He is essentially that character.
Mm-hmm.
He's just the sweetest old guy you can imagine.
He's going to win for me because he reminds me of my granddad.
Right, and I'll agree to that. I mean, I did warm up to Ed Gwynn more than I did Richard Attenborough, but I can't entirely fault Attenborough himself for that. It's just that Gwynn was so good.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that Attenborough did anything wrong. It's just that Gwynn was so amazing.
Exactly.
So why don't we talk about Elizabeth Perkins' Dory?
Exactly.
Again, in taking jabs at her, they kind of almost made her a little too prickly.
Yeah, she's a bit severe.
Yeah.
And I love Elizabeth Perkins.
I've seen her in good stuff too, but yeah, it's, again, they equate, if you're a non-believer, that means you have no warmth in your life. Even though she's shown as, you know, a very capable woman, and she very much loves her daughter, and there are some good moments that they share, they do play up this severity to her.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask, am I the only one who, until they actually said that the guy took off on her, I thought that the dad had died?
So did I. And in fact, it wasn't until the second time watching it again that I picked up on that.
Okay, so I wasn't the only one, because I was thinking like, oh, so the dad's dead. And then they mentioned that, you know, where he's telling Chris about what he had picked up from talking to her, from
to
conversations.
Susan, yeah.
And I'm just like going, oh, okay. So apparently he took off.
Right, I don't even think it said anything that they were even married. I think it was just she got pregnant.
Yeah, it's
no, they did marry.
Yeah, they did say that they did get married. So,
oh, okay,
probably
they get married, and he was drunk, and he left, or she left, or something happened. I don't.
Okay,
she got knocked up. He left. They could have just played it as he died. That would have made some of the severity make sense.
Yeah, I agree. I don't quite understand why they decided to go where they did there. That's kind of a weird John Hughes thing, if he'll leave something ambiguous and then someone will, like, make a story out of it.
Yeah.
A lot of people say that, you know, this was in the tail end of Hughes' career. I can see a lot of Hughes' writing in this film.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of the way the characters act, a lot of little moments here and there, the way the story's put together. In the later point of his career, it wasn't so much that he was, like, disinterested in stuff. It's just he was doing things more for the money because he was trying to fund other, like, independent projects like Reach the Rock, which no one ever ended up seeing and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he also produced this film, too, so he was on set and involved with it the entire time. You can feel the John Hughes thing, even though it's not probably his strongest work. I would say I feel more John Hughes in this than I do Les Mayfield.
Oh, yeah.
Mayfield feels like a director who just showed up to shoot what Hughes wrote.
Yeah, he's just here for the paycheck.
But I mean, like, you got little moments like Susan talking about, I'm trying to limit my sugar intake. That's a total John Hughes line.
Yeah.
I don't believe that for a second. I'm sorry. No kid will do that.
Well, she's supposed to be playing it as a little adult, yeah. So I guess.
Yeah.
I know, but I'm in my 20s, and when I go home from Christmas for college, I still expect there to be candy in my stocking by my parents. So.
Let's go ahead and talk about Mara Wilson as Susan.
She's adorable, but I think they were just trying too hard to make her different.
I disagree. I liked her. Mara Wilson was one of the good child actors of that period. She does have an intelligence and a warmth to her. I almost think Natalie Wood had a better look to her, like with those great little side-eye glares mm-hmm. that she would toss. Mara Wilson feels a little more authentic.
See, I would disagree with that.
Wood still had moments where she felt like a kid reading lines off a script. Sometimes.
See, I disagree with that. I find more Mara Wilson, there's times wherein I'm very aware that she's reading script pages, whereas with Natalie Wood, it felt much more natural.
I don't know. I think that it just was just they went too far with her, Susan.
With making her like a little adult.
Again, like yeah. the mom, they had to make her overdo the severity.
Yeah.
They went too far, yeah. And then we have to have the big moment at the end where she walks right up to the judge and gives him a Christmas card.
I wish that that had just been like a natural thing, but they do it like, oh, you know, it's so obviously planned out. I'm like, well,
I know. They even had to do the stop and the winks and everything.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, that sort of strips it of its innocence.
If she had done it on her own initiative and even yeah. Brian was sitting there like, wait, what's she doing? What's she doing? That would have worked, I think, a little bit better. But yeah, but that it was this whole concocted staged thing. It just feels kind of cynical then.
Yeah.
So, Dylan McDermott as Brian. He's pretty.
He does nothing for me, okay? This is, like, no.
He is not a movie star.
No. He's fine on TV. I think he used to be on The Practice
right.
or the Boston Legal, whichever one it was.
It was The Practice, which he did right after this one, too.
Yeah, I didn't watch either one. Yeah, he's fine on TV, but it's just no.
Yeah, he doesn't have that much charisma. And he's pretty to a degree that's almost kind of ridiculous. So it's not really even attractive anymore. It's just he's...
Well, to me, he's not even pretty. He's like a wax mannequin where there's just nothing for me to be attracted to.
He's like paper.
Yeah.
He's just
blank. You know what?
I'm now picturing every scene with a sheet of paper in place of his face. And it plays out exactly the same.
Yeah. If anything,
totally opposite because I was seeing like a giant piece of paper. Just
a giant piece of paper in a suit like
everyone's just acting off of a sheet of paper. Yeah.
I have this.
Yeah, he is just completely out of place here. It just, he doesn't feel authentic.
It kind of becomes a problem when you have some of the stuff that the original actor had a bit of charm to him. Would have worked here. They just kind of come off as a little smarmy.
Right. He doesn't have the charm. He doesn't have the charisma, and he doesn't have the chemistry with any of the other actors.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. What I do like is that him and Dory are already dating and already in a relationship
mm-hmm.
at the beginning of the movie, but you know there's still some strain there. I kind of like that.
Mind you, they're in a relationship, but I'm like, wow, you have no chemistry.
Yeah. From a plotting point of view, it simplifies why she trusts him with Susan and all that stuff, because you couldn't really just do it like you did in the 40s version.
No, in 94, there's no way you'd be able to pull off something like that.
Yeah, you can't have it just be, she's once again hanging out with that one guy that you haven't met yet.
It's like, I'll go get the pepper spray, you call the cops.
Yeah.
Also, you are so fired.
Exactly.
Okay, when he proposes, I am such a consumerist whore that I knew that was a Cartier box before she opened it. I am absolutely ashamed of myself. I'm like, oh, a Cartier box. And I'm like, I know that and a Tiffany's box. Ugh, I'm ashamed of myself. I'm a horrible person. I'll be in the corner.
Aw, but you're so pretty. Pretty for the corner.
Nobody puts baby in the corner.
I love her reaction. Wait, what?
What is this?
No. What's great about him is that I felt the honesty of that reaction, that she had absolutely no interest in marrying him.
Oh, yeah. No, I love when she's looking at the box and I'm like, hun, that's an engagement ring. You don't even have to open to know what that is. And then she opens it and she stares at it. And he's like, it's an engagement ring. And I'm like, I think she knows. I also don't think she wants to marry you.
Speaking of the engagement ring, I love how over the top that sequence is where Susan is looking at the Christmas tree and the ring is casting like this floodlight of reflection all over the room.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't think it works like that, but okay. I've never seen a diamond do that before, but Sure. Right?
And then Chris sending each of them letters addressed to each other, tricking them to just go to a church where a priest is just standing there waiting for them to agree to get married.
Yeah, and they show up. Well, I mean, the priest is like, what has changed between these two people that suddenly she's going to marry him? Like,
I know.
There was nothing that had changed that, and she's suddenly like, oh, yeah, you know what? Now I totally want to get married.
But now she's
like,
willing to put her faith in things.
That doesn't mean that.
I know.
Oh, my God. It doesn't work. It really doesn't. It's just suddenly like, and then they just got married. And it's just like, no.
Well, and then you also have that scene where Susan sees the ring. And then I love how Dory's standing there in her bathrobe. And then Brian walks out of the bedroom in his bathrobe because they totally did their wedding night boinking.
Yeah. And I'm like, I didn't need that. Thank you, movie.
It was an ejaculation miracle.
Ugh.
Sorry. It was, it was...
It's one of those things where I'm like, you know
what?
They didn't need to get married. I'm like, we didn't need that to conclude the story.
Yeah, we didn't need to see the wedding in order to know that these two are going to end up hooking up.
Yeah.
In the original, you have that great bit where you just find the house and they're like, well, maybe we should finally get married. It's like this one, they have to be married by the end. And that scene at the church, it was so awkward. I'm just staring at the priest like, dude, this is not going to turn out well, man.
It's like, this is ending in divorce. So maybe you should counsel them as a priest to think about what they're doing.
Right.
As far as I recall, the church's stand on divorce is not so good. So.
Right.
Yeah, maybe just, you know, count. No? Okay. Jane leaves, and I think it's J.T. Walsh as Alberta and Ed.
No, it's J.T. Walsh was the prosecuting attorney. It's James Remar.
James Remar, thank you.
I love James Remar.
I do too, but what exactly was their point in that movie? Like, God.
Let's get into the entire Shopper's Express of we have the evil corporation who's trying to buy the good store and trying to sabotage everything. And yeah, and it's basically just Jane Leaves and James Remar running around in rich suits making mischief.
Being evil. And then at the end, they both believe in Santa Claus. Oh, I'm like, what was the point of this? I'm like, no? Okay.
I did like the conversation in the limo about the Easter Bunny and winter in New Zealand.
Right. You know, that was actually one of the bits I liked about this film was how they slipped in those little Santa bits about his world and like the invisible workshop or how he stops time and whatnot.
Having dinner with hobbits. Don't judge me.
Okay, shut up. That'd be awesome. That'd be so awesome. Am I the only one who wanted Jane Leaves to be Dory? She would have been adorable. Right?
Yeah. I don't think she was a big enough name at the time to have gotten it, but yeah, that would have actually been nice.
Well, I don't think Elizabeth Perkins was a particularly big name back
then. She was more known than Jane Leaves was. I think this was still when Frasier was getting started.
Could be.
And then, of course, we have Simon Jones as Donald Shellhammer, the owner of Shopper's Express, who's evil and doesn't believe.
So very evil.
And I love how you can tell he's like a military commander because his table is full of an army of figurines just staring at him, waiting for orders.
The way that he's shot, too, and the way that he's lit, I'm like, are you guys gonna... No, okay, so there's no subtlety
here. At some point, he's gonna, like, pull out a pitchfork and, like, brimstone will, like, flare up behind him.
Dude, I thought he was gonna go full-on Patton on us. We're gonna go through that store like crap through a ghost.
Do a big speech in front of a giant Shopper's Express poster.
Oh my God. Like, he was so obviously evil.
I don't mind the idea that, yes, the store is struggling, and because of what Chris does, they're able to get out of the bank and, you know, deal with the competitors. But what I liked about the original film was, even as all these corporations are trying to bank on this, they're still getting in on this together and saying, you know, hey, this actually helps people out for the holidays.
Exactly.
And this one, it's only Kohl's. Only Kohl's ever does the good.
Yeah.
And here's the thing is, it was written as Macy's, but Macy's refused to sign off on it.
Really?
I wonder if it might be because of that entire angle of, you know, villainizing a rival corporation or something like that.
Well, it could also be the fact that it would be talking about Macy's going under or, you know, needing financial help, which also not good for your stocks, even if it's just fiction. So,
yeah. So I don't entirely know that that stuff was necessary, but I don't mind it.
Yeah.
I'm just surprised that they named it Kohl's when there actually is a store out there named Kohl's.
Actually, funnily enough, we in Canada have a bookstore, which is under the Indigo umbrella, which is Chapters, Coles, and Indigo. And we have stores called Coles with the spelling C-O-L-E-S that are bookstores.
Oh, I liked the moment with that girl, you know, in the original, she was Dutch, but in this one, she's deaf and mm-hmm. uses sign language.
That was nice. Yeah, especially when they're singing Jingle Bells together.
That was sweet. I think it's those moments that I really like the stuff that they recalled from the original that I really enjoyed, like with Richard Attenborough, especially.
Oh, Jack McGee as the drunk Santa who got fired and then comes back as a goon to harass him.
Okay, first of all, I love this actor. He played Chief Riley on Rescue Me. That's what I know him from.
Oh, character actor who's been in like a ton of stuff. I love that we totally get to see his ass in this film.
Hells yeah. So.
And I love that he actually does play the pedophilia card when he's harassing Chris.
Yeah, but at the same time, he's almost coming across as a pedophile. At least he did to me when he's just like, well, that's what they're good for. And I'm like, dude.
Right.
What,
it's like he's totally digging into his reasons for being Santa.
Yeah.
And projecting them onto this guy. And just the slimiest, slimy slime that you can slime.
The thing that cracked me up, though, is it's like the super shopper saver store of evil. They hired him. And so the first thing he does is he shows up at Kohl's around where all the kids and all their parents and a whole bunch of people can see and their security cameras. And he taunts him. And I'm like,
that's what I didn't get is why you would think they would have pulled security footage of that when Chris attacks him.
Yeah.
And it's a whole media sensation of, well, here we have evidence that he's been harassed. And that he's just going around in front of the kids saying, Santa Claus isn't real.
Yeah. There's precedent as to why, I'm like, he was baiting him.
So exactly.
It's like the fact that Chris hit him, I'm like, that's not, the only thing that ever becomes an issue here at this point is that Chris failed the, like, I guess.
Intentionally.
Yeah. And I'm like, that's not really a good enough reason to commit someone. But again, I don't understand American mental health laws and how you guys do stuff. So
if he has no family, then the state will commit him.
He's completely baiting Chris, and I'm just like going
exactly. Oh. And there's plenty of witnesses and plenty of evidence. I mean, there was no witness there on that street that night, but there is definitely showing precedence that yes, he has been doing this.
I also like the fact that they don't even have the balls to have Chris actually hit the guy.
Right, I know. The guy catches the cane with his hand and then pretends to be hit. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm just like, they're just incapable of even letting
him. We have all this time setting up the cane, and he doesn't actually hit him with the freaking cane.
I don't even understand why he stops it. I'm just like, well, why didn't you just let him hit you? Because at least then you'd have some kind of injury to play off of.
But I know. Well, it was a family film. You can't show violence, but you can show his ass.
Goodness.
Like, that's what surprised me was they really danced around any form of bad language,
mm-hmm.
yet they just show that guy's ass full on.
Well, which, again, if you want to, a Christmas family movie, fine. But Chris is justified in hitting him. So
yes.
It's almost like we want that as the audience.
Right, and
not
it doesn't have to be anything particularly violent. I mean, in the original, it's just a quick little clonk on the head.
It wasn't like he, beat him senseless in the original.
It wasn't like
he
dislocated his jaw or anything. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like clonk. That'll serve you right,
Yeah.
So Robert Protsky is the judge. One of my favorite character actors, Robert Protsky.
I know him from stuff, but I never know
another actor who's been in like everything for like the last 30 years.
He's that guy where I'm like, I know him from like everything.
He's that guy from that thing. Yeah. Exactly.
Good stuff, right?
Yes. He's totally one of those.
He was my Sean Bean for the longest time, wherein I'm like, you're in everything, aren't you?
Yes, but he actually lives in most of them.
Poor Sean Bean.
But yeah, I love Protsky because he captures the confliction. I mean, not really any better or worse than the judge in the original. I actually kind of like the little scene. The very first scene of the movie is him and his grandson on a corner, and Chris comes up next to them, and the kid's like, ask him. Oh, he thinks you're the real Santa Claus, and he leans down, I am. I remember that was like the big trailer for the movie, too. I don't entirely know if that was necessary to tie him into Chris earlier in the film, but it was fine. It was a nice little moment. I love the little pause he gets when he's like, oh, wait, it's that guy.
Well, I like the fact that it's only on my second viewing that I caught that it was him, because I'm like, until they actually say it, I didn't realize it was him.
They played it nicely. That was one of the moments where they didn't overplay it.
Like, it was a different opening from the original, but it was a nice opening.
It was.
It still worked.
I thought it worked a little better than the awkward, oh, all your reindeer are out of order.
Yeah.
That bit was cute, but it went on a little long. This one was just a nice little thing of a kid sees a guy with a beard and thinks he's Santa Claus. And the guy actually leans down and says he is. I mean, that's perfect Christmas fantasy moment.
Mind you, I didn't need the kid going, oh, I should have got his autograph. I'm like, shut up, kid.
Yeah.
I didn't need that from you.
Oh, yeah, he goes, aw, nuts.
Yeah.
Did either of you recognize the girl playing the elf in the little department store setup that they had?
I thought I've seen her somewhere before.
That's
but...
Jennifer Morrison from Once Upon a Time.
Yeah, House.
For real?
That's,
right.
That's Jennifer Morrison, yeah.
I didn't really get a good look at her face.
I kind of did, and I'm like, you seem kind of familiar, but you got a hell of a baby face.
Yeah, she was still in her teens when she did this movie. I saw her, and I'm like, that's Jennifer Morrison. And I went and I looked it up. It is! I think I caught it in her voice when she says, this is only for the kids, you know?
You're right, it does. I'm like thinking back now, and I'm like, it does sound like her.
Yeah. There were a lot of interesting, like Alice and Janney had that one scene as the mother.
He had
Mary McCormick as like a secretary in like one shot.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
they had Horatio Sands in there.
Sands working at the hospital. Yeah, it was just kind of an interesting, all these little familiar faces before they actually went on to become stars. What I liked about Horatio Sands is he kind of felt like a bit of a throwback to the Alfred character. Mm-hmm. In his, he only had the one scene.
God, I cannot remember this character at all.
Well, he's in it for, like, maybe just a half a second.
He's the husky guy who works at the mental hospital.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, who's just like, you know, listen, I mean, this guy, he's not like the other people that they bring in here and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, okay. No, it makes sense now.
He's Horatio Sands from Saturday Night Live.
I feel like the hearing and like the stuff after was just kind of like okay, and the whole thing with the house and the baby brother bit was kind of ridiculous.
Yeah,
baby brother punchline was cute, but that house was like ridiculously decked out for Christmas.
What I liked in the original was the fact that it just looked like a regular house.
Yeah, and it was empty and it was for sale. And this was, I mean, yeah, it's the house that they use for their catalog.
But it wouldn't have had real food. Like, all of that stuff would have been fake.
I think, you know, if they're going to give him the house, I don't think they would give him everything in the house.
I love the fact that it was for sale furnished. And I'm just like, who the hell just, like, sells their house furnished?
Well, this one wasn't for sale furnished. This was a house that was owned by the company that they used for their catalog photo shoots. They gave it to her as a bonus.
Okay. I was...
because it was a house that she had looked into buying a while back. And then I think she instead bought it for the company.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, it's their catalog house that they're then giving to her as a bonus for everything.
In lieu of cash, please accept this house. Enjoy paying property taxes on it.
A house that's probably a ways out and will make it very difficult for her to maintain the job in the city.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to entirely dislike this film because they do. We've been picking at the nits and pulling it apart from a lot of angles, but I do find a lot of genuine still warmth in this film. And there is still a lot of the magic of the original that they do capture. They don't capture as perfectly, but they get pretty close.
I think that's the thing, is it's like we have been ragging on it, but it is still a really sweet film.
Right.
The thing is, it doesn't have that same heart that the original did, but that doesn't mean that it's completely devoid
it
of everything.
It feels like they're trying to have the same heart, but they don't entirely understand how. Yeah. They're almost there. They're
not quite sure what worked the first time. So it's like they're trying, but they're not really sure what that was that they're supposed to be doing.
Right. It's close, but no cigar. They missed it by that much.
They were so close, but so far.
What was surprising for me to learn is I thought I remembered this movie being a success, but it wasn't. This film debuted at number 8 on the top 10 charts and only made $17 million throughout its entire theatrical run.
Oh.
Yeah, I think we all kind of remember it as being that.
And that's probably about how much it cost to make, if even. I mean, it probably cost about $20 million or $30. Yeah, this film kind of tanked, and I thought I remembered it being more prolific. I'm trying to remember if something else came out around that time that would have squashed it, because this feels like the type of film that would have been a hit.
Well, did it come out in the summer, or did it come out?
Oh, it came out in December.
Oh, okay.
Or it came out in November.
Is it December or is it the summer, Evie?
Came out in November.
It came out in November. It could be that it was too far away from Christmas. Mind you, we had a Harold and Kumar 3D Christmas that came out this year, and it didn't do anything, but I don't think anyone was really asking for a Harold and Kumar movie, but whatever. It could be that it was just too far away from Christmas for it to count.
Well, yeah. Could be. If you give me a second here, I was just looking around to see what else came out that year. Oh, here we go. The Santa Claus, the Tim Allen film The Santa Claus, came out the week before.
Okay, yeah, that would be why then.
Yeah, so that kind of stole its thunder, because that was a big hit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, because I don't think Double Dragon did it.
I wouldn't count out Double Dragon, but the chance it actually did anything at all was probably very minimal.
Right.
But yeah, no, I mean, Santa Claus had already come out. And I think comparing the two, I would say Santa Claus feels far more genuine than this one. This one's trying way too hard.
Yeah, this one's trying too hard to be sincere and it doesn't feel it. And Santa Claus, it's silly, but it kind of embraces that.
Yeah, it's like it was sincere.
It knows what it is and it just has fun with it.
Yeah, it wasn't like going to be the big message movie or whatever. It's just like, yeah, I'm Santa Claus now because I killed him.
Also, you know, what's going to be a bigger draw for audiences? Richard Attenborough sitting around talking about faith or Tim Allen in a fat suit? Any final thoughts on this film, or have we pretty much had our say on what we thought it did right, what it did wrong?
Dylan McDermott, piece of paper. The end. I love you, Allison Janney.
Yes. Well, why don't we go ahead to the final question of, if you had to pick one of these two films to watch once a year, every year, for the rest of your life, which would it be? Evie?
It'd be the original, though I know we nitpicked the 94 version. Like, it's still a good movie. It's just a matter of the original is better. It has a heart and a sincerity that is just kind of lacking in the remake that I really miss. That it felt more inclusive of everyone, that, you know, you didn't have to believe in whatever, because everyone likes to believe in, you know, some kind of magic, even if you're like 5 or 50.
Carrie, which would you pick?
The original.
Okay. Did you want to elaborate on that at all, or?
No.
Okay.
I like that original.
I also got to go with the original. You know, the remake is a good movie. It's a perfectly good movie. The problem is the original is a great movie. It's a tough act to follow, and they made a good film with the remake. It's worth watching. If you catch it on cable, it's a good holiday film, good for the family. But it just isn't as good as the original. And part of it is it didn't quite understand the ambiguity of the original, and it laces in this weird equivalency of adding God to Santa Claus. And I see why they added that in, but it adds a snide air of superiority of believers over non-believers. And it ends up taking jabs at someone who should be treated as like an equal person. And it really kind of gets under my skin when they do that. But it's small moments, and they're moments that I can look over, and it's a good film. But the original film is just truly magical. It's a film that you can't watch and dislike. If someone dislikes the original A Miracle on 34th Street, then they're probably Uwe Boll. But there's nothing wrong with the original film. It is just such a great film. There's things wrong with the remake, but they're small things, and they aren't things that undo it. So we're all pretty much in agreement that we prefer the original, though.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, Evie, you want to tell us what we're going to be doing next month?
Sure. Next month, we are going to ring in the new year with Alec Guinness from The Lady Killers in 1955, and then Tom Hanks from the same movie, but remade in 2004 by the Coen brothers.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to have Tessa back from our Ocean's 11 episode.
Yay!
And
is she going to be a pony again?
Yeah, probably. I don't think she's ever not a pony anymore.
That's true.
And awesome. It's going to be our one-year anniversary episode.
Woot!
Yay!
Does this mean we finally get potty trained? These diapers are really uncomfortable. I've got kind of a rash going on, you guys.
No, we're just going to catheterize you.
Okay, this one's in it.
Anyway, so we've been doing this show for a year. And I'm looking forward to our one-year anniversary, Evie, and years to another.
Chin-chin.
All right, Carrie, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me, even though I'm not myself right now completely.
Who are you? Are
you? Who do you think I am?
The one-armed man?
Archbishop Desmond Tutu?
Maybe I'm a pony. You just don't know.
I don't know if ponies get colds.
They probably do.
I wonder if there's a pony with a cutie mark of NyQuil.
I hate you so much.
You love it.
I'm never coming back. I'm kidding. I'll be back if you want me back.
But, no, we're never having you back.
Yeah, no, we're never. I'm sorry. We can never have you back. It's no.
Yeah. Well, fine. I'll just go find another podcast. Maybe I'll start my own. It'll be shinier.
It'll have more glitter.
Sparkle.
It'll be Sparklecast. Oh, no, wait. Then everyone will think it's about Twilight.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Good night, Evie.
Horsebot 3000 bless us, everyone.
Yay.
Hey.
To read show notes for this and every one of our episodes, please visit IHateLoveRemakes.com. The comment sections are open, so let us know what you think about the films discussed. I Hate Love Remakes is in no way affiliated with the copyright holders of the films discussed. All rights are reserved and no infringement is intended. I Hate Love Remakes is a Made of Fail production. MadeofFail.net. We were unpopular before it was cool.